This oral history compilation was recorded and edited by Graham Shirley and Frank Hymans, and is based on original interviews with 19 people. The project was commissioned by the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority and was completed in 2006. The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent, in whole or in part, the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority. Nearly all cultures have found ways of remembering wars and honouring war heroes. Some preserved their memory through myths and legends, and others built monuments. The Great War of 1914 to 1918 fostered a great community desire to establish many lasting memorials to all those who served their country, and many such memorials were constructed throughout Australia. However, after World War II, the Garden Club of Australia suggested an alternative to built memorials: the planting of a living memorial of trees between Sydney and Canberra to those Australians who had served in World War II. A preliminary committee, out of which the Remembrance Driveway Committee grew, was formed in 1952 to investigate this proposal. The work of this committee led to the development of avenues of trees, memorial parks, groves, and rest areas along the Hume and Federal highways.
What's better than looking at a tree? Much better than looking at a piece of concrete. A tree's got character, it's got beauty, it's got everything.
Instead of having stone monuments in every country town, we've got these living trees all the way between Sydney and Canberra, which can be renewed and which do renew themselves and which, I suppose, demonstrate the ongoing development of the nation.
Starting from those early beginnings, it was a very big idea, which may not have even worked. But when I think about it, from 1952 up till now, we've progressed a long, long way, more than you could imagine.
It brings the past into the present. It provides this linkage between the actions of terrific Australians and brings them into the here and now. The second thing I think it does is raises awareness. We need to be mindful of what people did so we could have this great country of ours. And the third thing, and it's by no means the last, of course, is that it serves the purpose of a safety program. Simply by people choosing to stop and look and read and listen and take in the surroundings and perhaps reflect, they are achieving that very important purpose of having a rest during their journey.
Remembrance Driveway, the route from Sydney to Canberra, is a 300-kilometre living memorial dedicated to those Australians who served in World War II, Korea, Malaya, Borneo, South Vietnam, East Timor, and other theatres around the world. It's a very special road, and there is nothing else quite like it in Australia. This oral history tells the story of Remembrance Driveway and the background of some of the people who have contributed to it. Charlotte Webb studied horticulture, and while working on a Master of Heritage Conservation, she developed an interest in Remembrance Driveway.
I'm a landscape designer based in Barrow. As far as business is concerned, for many years I ran a nursery. I ran a wholesale and then set up as a retail nursery. And after a tractor accident, discovered I couldn't do physical things anymore. That's why I then went into design. In carrying out my research, there was a move at the end of the First World War to create what they called Australia Avenue, and that was to run from Sydney to Melbourne. And all the councils along the route that that road ran through were approached about participating in it. The idea was to plant sections of the same species with a sign at either end saying what the species was. And it was a scheme to show off the Australian natives.
The Australia Avenue proposal never eventuated, but the idea of having a remembrance driveway originated in the early 1950s with Margaret Davis, the first president of the Garden Club of Australia. She'd been inspired by the Blue Star Highways concept in the United States.
The Blue Star Highways were started by Garden Clubs of America. The name was chosen from the original Blue Star that was hung out in the front windows of families who had somebody in the household who was serving in World War I. And there may actually be multiple Blue Star flags hung out. And they were a very small flag with a blue star with a white and red background. And if someone in the household was actually killed in conflict, the blue star was changed for a gold star. And those blue star highways cross America north to south, east to west, but they're not in whole lengths. As we have the rumoured driveway from one capital city to another, the blue star highways were sections of highways. So it's not just one road, whereas ours is on one road. Margaret was trying to find some type of project for the Garden Clubs of Australia to get them onto the map, as anybody would. Her original concept was actually to have it cover right across Australia, and then that was just not achievable. When Margaret Davis had this idea, this was very much after the C.W. Bean Parks and Playground movement, after the First World War, to actually bring in functional memorials, so it's no longer just a statue or a monument. And the Remembrance Driveway came in at the same time as a functional type of monument, a functional area for people to go, to seek as a destination, to actually go and enjoy and experience.
Alan Corrie grew up in Sydney during the Second World War.
We found the whole thing quite exciting. The brownouts, brown paper over all the windows, and there were wardens who came round, and if too much light was actually showing through the window, you'd get a knock on the door. As kids, we were involved in that, and I was at Burwood Public School at the time, and I can remember the air raid shelters being dug there by all the fathers of the students at the weekend. My cousin and I used to spend Saturday afternoons at the local School of Arts making camouflage nets. And again, we thought we were really doing something very good for the war effort.
In 1946, Alan Corrie became an apprentice at the Sydney Botanical Gardens and started a remarkable 40-year career as one of Australia's foremost landscape architects. His first involvement with Remembrance Driveway was in 1954, when he came into contact with Margaret Davis.
She was a very formidable person. She used to sort of sweep into the gardens and wanted immediate attention. But later on, when I was doing my own research on Remembrance Driveway, I interviewed her in the United States, and of course she was quite an old woman by this time, and she'd mellowed considerably. In fact, she was a wonderful person to interview. But one very, very interesting sort of aside on Margaret Davis was that she'd learnt to fly an aircraft before she even learnt to drive a car. She felt that the Garden Club of Australia was virtually the be-all and the end-all of everything. Everything revolved around that. And I think she felt that when she came into the gardens, everything had to be dropped and attention had to be given to Margaret Davis. Very rich woman was Margaret, but an extremely liberal woman in the money that she gave for not only the garden club, but other garden activities, but also for particularly for conservation. She would give quite large sums of money for conservation, particularly for animal conservation.
In order to realise her dream of building a remembrance driveway, Margaret Davis enlisted the help of retired Army General Sir Frank Berryman.
Margaret Davis had a very, very high regard for him. He was the one who, I suppose, was one of those people who knew the right people, you know, had the ear of people in the right places at the right time.
How important was it for the driveway to have the ear of the right people at the right time?
I think absolutely crucial. One individual like Margaret Davis would never have been able to do this. The influence of people like Berryman was entirely essential to its success.
Another player in this remarkable saga was the Royal Botanical Gardens curator and chief botanist, Bob Anderson.
Anderson, of course, I don't think can be underestimated for his knowledge of plants. And as a scientist, he just simply knew what would be the right species and what was going to be the best sort of locations for success.
The first Remembrance Driveway Committee was formed. Joining it was Nigel Ashton, later to become chairman of the State Planning Authority of New South Wales.
Ashton knew how to acquire land at the time, and he knew how it was possible to gain public ownership to certain parcels of land. So he was absolutely essential, I think, to the whole running of the organisation.
Nigel Ashton was born in 1911 and recalls troop ships returning from the First World War.
I went to Melbourne as a baby and lived there for 10 years when the city was really just adjusting itself to the new era of the motor car. You were used to still use cabs, and many of the deliveries were by horse-drawn vehicles, and trams were mostly cable car.
In 1934, Nigel Ashton was articled as a clerk with a firm of architects in Melbourne. Then, in order to gain some overseas experience, he travelled to London in 1936. There, he worked on drawings for alterations to the annex of Westminster Abbey.
I was working to begin with His Majesty's Office of Works, on the Westminster Abbey and its alteration for the coronation of Edward VIII. And I was doing the working drawings for the annex they put in on the front of the west doorway, where the royalty could refresh themselves after the procession and before going into the long and arduous service, no doubt, for them. And I always laugh that in the middle of these drawings, the king decided to abdicate, so instead of having just the king and his entourage to deal with, we had to deal with a royal couple. So we had to find the quarters and all the other ancillary requirements for the queen and her entourage as well in this annex, so that had to change the plan a bit.
Nigel Ashton returned to Australia at the beginning of the Second World War and became a town planner. He recalls the day that the Queen and Prince Philip officially opened the driveway on their first visit to Australia in 1954. They planted two London plane trees at Macquarie Place in Sydney.
Proper subject, we waited for the royal couple to arrive and they planted the trees. I wasn't in the forefront of the committee. It was Sir Frank who was not only the chairman of the committee but also the director of the royal tour, so he had a good part to play.
Bob Anderson was a member of that first committee, and I can remember him being very opposed to the planting of the first memorial trees in Macquarie Place, because I don't know that anybody really knows about this, because I picked it up in my research, that to do that, a number of fig trees, Moreton Bay fig trees, would have to be removed. He said there's no room to get additional planting here in Macquarie Place, and he suggested a number of other alternatives, one of them, of course, being the Botanic Gardens. Anyhow, that was all to no avail. They finally did plant them in Macquarie Place. And two Moreton Bay fig trees were actually removed. That, of course, wouldn't happen today. You couldn't remove magnificent fig trees, even for the Queen of England.
The royal couple also planted a solitary snow gum at the end of the driveway in Canberra. After this, plantings began in earnest, as Nigel Ashton recalls.
The first planting was by the Garden Committee down at Lansdowne Bridge. Forget why that wasn't... Oh, I know why it wasn't successful, because they wanted to put in deciduous trees which weren't hardy enough for the Australian climate. And so they were later replaced by spotted gum, which is a very hardy tree and indigenous to the Bankstown area. There's another group of trees along that particular route, lemon-scented gum, but they were planted on the most barren piece of gravelly country that I can imagine, but they survived because they come from the middle of North Queensland, so they're used to very tough conditions, and they've survived, and that's the Qantas Memorial Drive, and they're very successful, I think. Well, we knew that what they started to plant in 1954 ultimately would not be the future Hume Highway or the Remembrance Driveway, but you had to start somewhere, so we started there. And that planting down at Hume Highway between Strathfield and Liverpool, and there's some fine avenues along there that were planted in the 1950s.
Charlotte Webb adds,
the original plantations, they originally started to do them as a plaque per tree to commemorate one individual person. Then they decided that was too difficult and it fell in a heap. So they did plantations for a group. And the group usually, regardless of rank or age or service, it was just to a group.
We asked Alan Corry to define what a plantation consists of.
A plantation was perhaps more informal. It was the opposite, if you like, of the idea of an avenue planting, where trees were equally spaced along a straight line. Much more informal and certainly not a continuous line. Also, I guess there would have been a mixture of species, whereas most avenues tend to be of one particular species.
Under the direction of Margaret Davis, the Remembrance Driveway became a preoccupation of various branches of the Garden Clubs of Australia.
They would take this as a project, often a long-term project, maybe several years in advance. And not only did they find the money, but they often would buy the plants, do the planting, and then maintain them forever afterwards. There was a problem in terms of the Remembrance Driveway Committee in allowing someone else to have this sort of involvement. And one of the problems was in the choice of species. The garden clubs, as one imagines, are garden-oriented, and they wanted the more attractive, to their way of thinking, the more attractive species. And this usually equated with introduced plants, and particularly flowering plants or plants that were autumn-coloured. They didn't like Australian species. So there, if you like, there was a slight conflict between what the garden clubs were doing or allowed to do, because they wanted to do it all. They didn't like to, to be restrained by the Remembrance Driveway Committee, particularly in the choice of species. And there were many instances where this was a real conflict.
Another influential member of the committee was Charles Moses.
He was chairman of the ABC at the time and was responsible for a lot of the publicity that Remembrance Driveway got through the ABC. Everybody knew about it. It was very well publicised on the radio and, of course, by that time, television. Many of the schools were involved, so school kids were very much aware of it. Perhaps the thing that really did take people's attention was that with Remembrance Driveway, people really did. They could see where their money had gone. They could, in fact, go to the commemoration, the day that the trees were actually commemorated. People felt this was adding beauty to a particular part of the landscape, and I guess there was something sort of almost a grassroots level there that people could say, I'm responsible for some of these trees here. I think perhaps one of the problems was the length of time it took the trees to grow, and so people tended to lose a little bit of interest after a while. They'd go back year after year and find that there was very little evidence of any growth in the trees. I think another real problem was that it took so long, often before any of the trees were planted using the money that people had given. Individuals were paying £10 for a tree. £10 was a lot of money in those days. And I think perhaps the one that I found most poignant, I guess, was the woman who wrote and said that she couldn't pay £10 immediately for her tree to her husband or son or someone like that, but she would be able to do it in instalments. And she did this, and finally did pay off that £10, and it was quite evident to me that she was using part of her pension, because these instalments came about every month. But the ones that had the highest profile tended to be the ones that had sponsorship.
I mean, it was also tax deductible at the time, so any of these sponsorship programs were. So it actually made it attractive for companies to come and do. At one stage, there were awards given to sponsors, and I found invitations to the sponsors to come down to receive their award by the Remembrance Driveway for being involved. And the council supported it. The council waived the rates and those sorts of things. For each year, the Remembrance Driveway went back and renegotiated with council to ask for relief from the rates, and the council each year agreed.
Major General Kevin Latchford is a retired career army officer. He was posted to Japan and Germany after the war, joined the 1st Armoured Regiment in 1949, and became a commanding officer in 1970. In 1968-69, he served in Vietnam as commanding officer of the 1st Australian Civil Affairs Unit.
It was fascinating, I found, once I got into it, producing village water supply systems. We're using Southern Cross windmills, which no one had ever built. We built one as a training exercise in Nui Dat before we went out and started them off in the villages. When I got home, I felt we'd achieved quite a lot. In fact, I think all the people in the unit, officers and NCOs and soldiers, all felt that they'd contributed something useful in their year in Vietnam, and they had something to show for it, really.
On his return to Australia, Kevin Latchford became Director General of Recruiting
and Director General of the Natural Disaster Organisation before retiring after 39 years of service. In 1989, he became President of the Remembrance Driveway Committee. He reflects on what the driveway meant to individual communities along the route during its first 20 years.
It'd been established in the days when everyone was enthusiastic and they used to go out and cut the grass there with their own lawn mowers, and they built children's slides and playground equipment and picnic tables and things and in their own backyards and put them out there. Down in the Southern Highlands, there'd been a major source of activity down there under the local chairman of the auxiliary, and they produced very attractive plantations at Berrima and also at on the outskirts of Mittagong and Bowral. On the Illawarra Highway, I might add, we had Remembrance Driveway on the Illawarra Highway and on the old Hume Highway as well. We've got a real plethora of plantations down there, all of which are very, you know, attractive trees, and they grow very well in the Southern Highlands. Because of the arrangements that were made down in the Southern Highlands, most of these plantations are on private property.
Leonie Knapman's father planted trees for the Southern Highlands plantations in the mid-1950s. Ever since, Leonie has been fascinated by the history of Remembrance Driveway. She began to explore the records of the driveway, quite an achievement in the light of her earlier life.
My father was out driving at the age of 12. He didn't go to school, so consequently he couldn't read or write. I often wondered as a youngster why my mum did a lot of things for him. So as a girl, education wasn't that high up on my dad's list. So when I was 18, I still couldn't read or write properly. I decided that I had to do something about that. I'm still not an academic. I'm 65 now. But I've written books, produced a half-hour video. That's what you do with your life. Get up and do something about it. And this is one of the reasons I got involved with the Remembrance Driveway. Because of our settlement of English people so early, we have a lot of English and European trees. And so this is one of the reasons that I interviewed Clarice Boyd, who was a long-time resident here, and her husband Ernie and their son went to Melbourne when the trees were to be planted here, and Mr. Hoskins, who owned the cement works at the time, or was involved with the cement works, decided that trees from New Zealand would grow very well here. And so he bought different types, one lot that would come up fairly early, flower, grow quickly, and you'd have a lot of pleasure within a short time. And by the time they got to the end of their lifespan, you would have the other beautiful trees coming in. So the New Zealand climate was much the same as here, so consequently he chose particular types.
Tell me a bit more about Cecil Hoskins himself. I mean, what sort of a man was he?
If he went into something, he'd go into it wholeheartedly. And he actually knew all of the names of all the trees and all the shrubs throughout each of the areas. And of course he also placed them to get maximum effect against the different colours, because all your firs and your pines and that are all different shades of green. And he used to be found every morning driving out there, checking the trees and having a look at them. He wanted to do things his way. He went to the trouble through BHP and so on to bring the trees across from New Zealand. Clarice Boyd, whose husband went down with her son to bring the trees back, and it was wet and they kept getting bogged and the highway was flooded and they'd have to go through properties, and it took them ages to get the trees back here. They were lucky that they were able to use all the works. Well, it was Southern Portland Cement then, and they were able to use their equipment and trucks and so on. But for some reason, they ended up doing their own thing here in the Southern Highlands. Actually, right up until the 1990s, they still kept the books here. The money was still here that was raised.
He was a bit of a law unto himself, and he literally ran his own bailiwick. And I think Hoskins was such an important figure, I guess he gave large donations of money, but nobody was sort of game to tackle him on what he was doing.
Charlotte Webb remembers.
The Berrima District Auxiliary was Sir Cecil. He went and talked to all his mates in the mining industries and got them to sponsor plantations by either paying for actual sponsorship, buying land, and also contributing each year to the maintenance.
Why was it that there was such a high percentage of Remembrance Driveway plantations in the Southern Highlands?
Because I think Sir Cecil was a very dedicated man. And I think he sort of started and he just probably kept going. And I think You know, it's interesting that there's one at Mittagong and there's the RSL there. There is one in Bowral, and then all of a sudden at Sutton Forest, which was never on the route, there are four of them. And the ones at Berrima, that's on the front of his property being the cement works, and then his neighbours. And they're all done by his industrial friends.
Today, Judy Keast represents the Garden Clubs of Australia on the Remembrance Driveway Committee. Her father worked at the Bank of New South Wales, and Judy also joined the bank after leaving school.
I learnt to be a teller. I was the first woman teller in the bank, and I had to learn how to shoot. So I did pistol shooting, which was rather fun.
What was your earliest awareness of Remembrance Driveway?
As I was a member of the Bank of New South Wales, it was circulated through the bank, through their magazine called the Etruscan, that they were going to participate in this, which everyone, because it was after the war and everybody needed something to remember the people who had actually participated in the war. And I think that was probably the first time that really came home to me that this was a wonderful project. And the bank subsequently did take up a plantation in Berrima, and as I understand, it was being maintained by bank members.
What did that actually mean?
Well, as I understand it, there were groups of them that would have they'd have a car trial or a car rally down, have a picnic and help maintain it and clean it.
Sally Colina joined the Federal Committee of the Garden Clubs of Australia and is a former president. She explains the aims of the garden clubs, of which there are 600 affiliated branches.
It's friendship through gardens, keeping people together, working their ideas on the community. A lot of community effort is done with the garden club. There's special awards for various efforts within their zones or clubs that people have done so much towards charities, towards promoting beautification of roads. It's just a wonderful feeling. It's a sort of a trap when you get into it. It's a very tender trap, gardening. But there, once you're in it, you never get out of it. It's just a never-ending story.
The Garden Club's involvement in Remembrance Driveway contributed to its early success.
There were garden clubs down in Goulburn, very much involved in planting. The Bowral and Mittagong clubs down in the Southern Highlands were great, who planted trees, and so there were quite a few garden clubs around that did a lot of planting for us and keeping an eye on things. And I think it is a communal spirit that these people have. It was an eye-opener for me.
Looking at the amount of public support, and obviously there was a huge public support for Remembrance Driveway in its first 10 years, what happened after that first 10 years?
I guess 10 years is a fairly long time, particularly with people who were maybe old at the time they started. And I guess with all things, there's going to be an initial sort of exuberance. And unless that momentum can be kept up, people are going to lose interest. But certainly I would imagine, A number of those people died, and B, the initial interest just had to wane.
Facing reduced funding, the Remembrance Driveway Committee continued throughout the 1960s and 70s. From the mid-1970s, the then Department of Main Roads, now the Roads and Traffic Authority of New South Wales, became more involved in assisting the committee. Ian Burke is the RTA's representative on the committee.
My first exposure to the committee was in my position with the DMR as a landscape officer, and from my sort of horticultural background, I guess I became an RTA representative on the committee. The RTA has always seen the Remembrance Driveway Committee as a valuable resource, I guess, for our activities, and our goals are sort of both aligned, really.
Ian Burke soon realised that maintenance of the plantations was a major challenge for the RTA.
It's very easy to put a tree in the ground, but it's a lot bigger challenge to look after it and make it grow to a healthy state. So, I mean, when we do get a large-scale tree planting ceremony happening, I'm equally conscious of the commitment that we're making for the maintenance of those trees. And unfortunately, in the climate we have, we can't guarantee on the natural elements to make the tree survive. When a tree is first planted, we like to see it given 20 litres of water 5 days a week. There's the heavy mulching around the plant to stop the root ball drying out. We've got the water absorbent crystals that can be worked in with a planting mix that extend the moisture holding capacity of the soil. There's been big improvements in fertilisers, for instance. And one of the earlier problems we had with a lot of the eucalypt planting, and particularly areas like Yarra, was absolutely devastation by insect attack, and we lost a lot of plants that way.
The challenges faced by the RTA and the committee were increased because the route of the Hume Highway itself was changing with the construction of new freeways. Kevin Latchford remembers.
At that time, we faced a major dilemma because the southeastern freeway was just being completed between Campbelltown and Almerton, and that cut out a large section of the old Hume Highway through Razorback, Picton, Vargo, all those little towns all the way down there. And so we had to make a decision whether we'd stay with the original route, which was hopefully become a tourist road, or go with the main artery. We both contributed to the hiring of some consultants in North Sydney, and they did a report on the future of the driveway, and they recommended, in fact, we stay with the old Hume Highway. And
what was their reason for that?
They felt that no one would stop on the improved freeway, that everyone would be whizzing past at 100 kilometres an hour, and also the towns along the way would benefit by the tourist traffic, which was supposed to develop along the road, but I don't think it ever has. It's just reverted to a backcountry road. But yes, we had quite a lot of argument about that, and I don't think the consultants were all that impressed with it when we went the other way, and I made the decision, and the committee endorsed it, that we would go with progress virtually and go with the new alignment.
The situation was further compounded when new sections of freeway bypassed existing plantations along the highway.
When the Mittagong bypass went in and the Berrima bypass went in, that caused another problem, virtually, with what to do with the Southern Highlands plantations, and many years of argument went on about that. Well, they said, you know, you can't abandon this, you know, and nor we could, because they were all memorial plantations. They all had stones and bronze plaques on them, and in the end we said, well, you know, we've got to make the decision to stay with the main route, but we won't abandon the plantations. We'll look after them. We still do. We maintain them, cut the grass, etc., but there are problems. They're not on RTA-controlled land. Because of the arrangements that were made down in the Southern Highlands, most of the plantations are on private property. And no one, not even the council, knows the details of the ownership thing. So that's a very big question mark about the future of them.
To what extent are the plantations in the Southern Highlands being maintained today?
Well, it's very sad to see, because something that had such input, and probably when it was being run by Sir Cecil and Claude Crowe, and he was a main player. Claude Crowe would go over and prune each year and very rarely put in a bill for it. So he would actually go over and maintain those ones at Berrima, not necessarily the mowing, but the actual trees. And since Claude Crowe died, and Sir Cecil obviously moved on, the plantations are simply mown, and there's very little work that's done in them, and you can see it, they're starting to fall into disrepair, which is sad to see, and I think that's one of the reasons I got involved, to see what we can do about them. They're in a bypassed area of the Remembrance Driveway, so they're no longer considered part of the main Remembrance Driveway. But they still have their social significance, they still have their historic significance, and they have an enormous amount of horticultural significance. And they'd be very interesting for a future horticultural study on what happens in the survival of all these exotics in the Australian conditions.
To continue to exist and flourish, the Remembrance Driveway needed a new lease of life. This came in the form of an ambitious plan to establish new rest areas along the highway that would be dedicated to Victoria crosswinners. Ian Burke explains.
The VC rest areas, I guess, resulted from discussion on how we may further promote the Remembrance Driveway and perhaps lift its profile in the eyes of the travelling public. I think the first thoughts for rest areas, well, yes, there's a resource we could use, and we were talking about, well, do we name them after significant battles of the Second World War? That may be so, but I think what we ended up with was probably a much better outcome in naming them after VC winners.
Sally Kalina recalls.
It says, you know, that we thought of it as a committee, but I honestly feel General Latchford was really the man behind that. And then it was broached on a committee meeting, and then we all thought, fabulous idea.
Kevin Latchford put forward the proposal.
And so we approached the RTA and suggested that this would be a good thing. It fitted in with the RTA Rest, Revive, Survive program, which are pushing heavily at that stage. But I said, you know, if they're going to be VC memorial rest areas, they've got to be improved. We've got to sort of come up with a reasonable standard of picnic table accommodation with roofs over the top, maybe water tanks, some trees and things, and generally improve the entrances and the parking and make them more attractive to people. And it was agreed, and so we started on that in 94 with the first one down at Rose's Lagoon, and we got that underway. And then fortunately we invited John Sharp, the Minister for Transport, along to the opening of that, and Gurney. We opened Gurney on the same day. And he was so attracted with the idea that within about a month later, I was rung up by the Department of Transport in Canberra saying, you come down to Canberra next week and Mr. Sharp and Mr. Scott want to see you. So I went down there to be told that they were going to spend $4 million on the BC rest area program, and it was to be extended to cover all 22 at that stage. And just to sort of get the show underway, they gave me $50,000, I think, to help defray our expenses in the establishment of the thing. So this got it underway.
Commodore Ian Calloway is the current president of the Remembrance Driveway Committee. He joined the Royal Australian Navy as a 15-year-old cadet midshipman in 1953 and retired in 1992. He specialised in gunnery and missile warfare and was commanding officer of HMA ships Anzac and Stalwart. He served as gunnery officer on HMAS Hobart in Vietnamese waters in 1968.
I was the gunnery officer of HMAS Hobart and was the gunnery officer in Vietnam when we were struck by missiles. Fired by an American Phantom in a very confused period right on the DMZ. He thought we were a helicopter. And so he fired four missiles at us. The first two did considerable damage to our anti-aircraft missile system and killed a couple of the ship's company. The second two came in and did a bit more damage. And then he was coming in for a third attack, and we managed to fire the forward 5-inch gun, and he turned away. Very thankful we were.
Commodore Calloway joined the Remembrance Driveway Committee in 1994. He comments on the criteria that the committee and the RTA use for locating the VC rest areas.
When we first started the program, we looked at areas that were already rest areas. So they were the first ones off the list of dedications. And then we started looking at areas which could be converted to rest areas, like gravel dumps. And we're now at the stage when we're building a rest area that's from scratch. The major part of the expenditure is the new highway lanes that have got to be built, deceleration, acceleration lanes. And there's one down just north of Goulburn at Tarang Creek, which is a wonderful rest area. It was one of the very first garden clubs of Australia type rest area, and the local Goulburn Garden Club planted a lot of trees. They're lovely exotic trees, and it's on the site of the original Sydney to Melbourne Road. And then there's an old convict built bridge in this rest area. That was a very expensive rest area to build, but it is a wonderful rest area. Beautiful trees there. It was a stockade for the convicts working on the highway too. There's quite a bit of local history around that area. The convicts were held in the stockade while they were building the original road and the original bridge that's still standing. It's a lovely, lovely old stone bridge.
David Farquhar is the Remembrance Driveway Committee's treasurer.
I did 2 years in the Army in National Service in 1965. I was in the Air Dispatch Unit, so I was trained as a parachutist.
David Farquhar made history by becoming the first National Serviceman to parachute out of an aircraft. Today he directs his energies towards the Remembrance Driveway. He remarks on the difficulty to find new sites for VC rest areas, particularly in the ACT section of the driveway.
The last few, especially in ACT, there aren't any sites to establish rest areas. On a freeway, you just can't pull off onto the side of the road and say, we're going to have a rest area here, or plant a plantation. And especially in the ACT, it's nearly all built-up area. So we've had to establish memorials in existing parkways and parklands, and we were fortunate in that behind the war memorial there was a big grassed area that was used as the overflow parking, and we received permission to establish VC memorials in there, and we've now got four in that park in Canberra.
Remembrance Park is the official end of the driveway. Steve Amos was project coordinator with Canberra Urban Parks and Places when he was assigned to establish the VC memorials in Canberra.
There was a series of eucalypt trees there, and I think there was a small park symbolising the end of Remembrance Driveway. We engaged a designer here in Canberra to come up with a design of how could we do the park? How could we sort of link what has been happening in Sydney, what's happened along the Federal Highway, and put it here in Canberra at the end? So a few meetings and designs, we come up with the current design that we have there now, and we have what we have there today. So we have two little great picnic areas for behind the war memorial, and they've got a shelter, terrific barbecues, drinking fountain, and some park furniture as well. And also you've got your VC description sign, which gives you, you know, a bit of history about what they did to receive their VC, and it looks really nice. And in addition to that, we've planted three trees. That's sort of the main entrance. It's sort of like in the shape of a semicircle and an arch. We got the Governor-General at the official opening. He planted three trees there and officially declared that site part of the Remembrance Driveway.
Ken Bradley also represents the Garden Clubs of Australia on the Remembrance Driveway Committee. He volunteered because of his past experience with war veterans at Hellfire Pass in Thailand. There, he was instrumental in setting up a memorial to commemorate prisoners of war under the Japanese who had built the infamous Thai-Burma Railway.
A lot of them gave me the impression that they still remembered the time when they returned to Australia and they had a problem in discussing their experiences. They hadn't been involved in a battle or something heroic. I think at the back of their minds they have this feeling that they've done something disgraceful, they've been captured. They were still seeking recognition. Some of them felt guilty that they had survived and their friends hadn't. And this memorial was a way of saying, hey, it was all worthwhile.
Ken Bradley talks about what has impressed him about being part of the Remembrance Driveway Committee.
I think the thing that stands out the most is the dedication. I've seen one dedication of a new site in the time I've been on the committee. I very much appreciated being involved in that. It was extremely wonderful during the ceremony to have a man step forward and say, I was beside this person on that action in which he earned the VC. And then I got to talk to this guy who was just an ordinary farmer and his family afterwards. That was very satisfying to have a time to talk with the guy that was right there.
Brigadier Gary Biles is a retired Army officer on the Remembrance Driveway Committee. His overseas postings were at US Army Command and General Staff College, where he graduated as an instructor. He became Chief of Staff, Army Training Command, at Victoria Barracks in Sydney. He has subsequently forged a new career at the Attorney General's Department as Sheriff of New South Wales. One ceremony that stands out for him was the Partridge VC dedication.
It was a terrific experience. It was a small but very relevant crowd that attended. And in Frank Partridge's case, we gathered just outside Campbelltown there, and there was a chance for a couple of people to speak about the man. It was one of his mates who talked about his actions with him and what sort of soldier he was and how his bravery resulted in his award. And that was moving in itself, because with a military background, and even though some of the military jargon was coming through, you could understand and you could almost visualise the action as you stood there listening to this old soldier recall all the memories of the past. Moving a bit like Anzac Day, that same sort of emotional feeling. The other important aspect of the ceremony, I felt, and it was all very touching. It was the talk by Frank Partridge's son. I remember him discussing his father and how he sort of grew up with him in tough times and how difficult it was and the commitment of Frank Partridge. And I'm just wondering whether that had something to do with his heroism on the battlefield and the fact that it was tough and he was a tough man and he showed that courage, that moral fibre that perhaps contributed to his bravery award. It was very moving to hear the son talk about his dad and how life with him was.
Air Commodore Frank Burt is the first ex-Royal Australian Air Force officer on the Remembrance Driveway Committee. He flew Phantom and F-111 aircraft and commanded the Point Cook and Laverton air bases. He was also present at the Partridge VC dedication ceremony.
I think the greatest accolade that Barry Jones paid to Frank Partridge after Barry Jones won the Picker Box on television. In fact, I remember watching Partridge on television. I used to be glued to the set because he had this encyclopedic knowledge. He knew everything. Barry Jones's greatest tribute that I think he's paid to anyone was to Partridge when he said, look, you know, I won this thing fine, but you know, I've had the benefit of a university education and a Rhodes Scholarship and all of those sorts of things. He said, and here's this man who hasn't been to university, who's a self-educated man who just read books by the light of a kerosene lantern, and to me, he's far superior in intellect to me because he's self-taught.
Kevin Latchford recalls.
It's remarkable the support we've had from the families. When we did Percy Gatwick down at Collector, terribly wintry day, we had 15 members of his family come over all the way from Western Australia for it. And then when we did Kibby, which is just south of Yarra Junction, his daughter came all the way from Cairns for it. And when we did Anderson, down at the south end of Lake George, we had half the population of West Wyalong come to it, I think. They came over in buses because he was a well-known figure at West Wyalong after the war. So it's had big support from members of the unit associations and also from families, every one of them. But it takes a bit of organising, I can tell you.
People couldn't miss these VC rest areas as they drove down to Canberra from Sydney. And an amazing number of people stop in these rest areas. In fact, some people have written to us saying they stop in every one, just to read the citation. So obviously the VC rest area program reinvigorated the driveway and the concept of the driveway.
Why is it so important through these rest areas to recognise the Victoria Cross winners?
Well, the Victoria Cross is the highest bravery award that was available, and certainly in the British Commonwealth. It was the pinnacle of bravery and self-sacrifice. Dedication to your country, fighting for king and country, queen and country, and all of those things. And I still firmly believe that people need heroes, and the memory of those people should be kept alive, their heroism and their bravery, particularly the concept of fighting for your country. And I think heroism is probably one of those things that is fast disappearing. I was born during World War II. You know, that sort of generation had a lot of war heroes to look up to and things like that. These days, heroes seems to be television stars and soapy stars and sporting heroes. And sure, they're leaders in their particular field, but it doesn't encompass those feelings of citizenship, mateship, looking after your mate, putting your life on the line, I guess, for your friend, and saving your mate's lives and things like that.
With many VC rest areas now dedicated, is there an oversupply of rest areas on the Sydney to Canberra drive? Ian Calloway responds.
24 rest areas between Sydney and Canberra is a lot more rest areas than the standards require. But it's a remembrance driveway, so it's not a normal stretch of highway. You can become a bit spoilt for rest areas when you're driven to Canberra. If you drive elsewhere around the state, you'll be looking, searching high and low for rest areas when you need one.
Ian Burke adds,
we're finding all those areas are well patronised, and I guess there's the tourist traffic aspect of these as well. One of the drawbacks we've found with the rest areas, though, is by putting the recycled toilets into them, we're having a lot of trouble with maintenance because we're getting caravans, for instance, emptying chemical toilets into them, and that's destroying the bacteria to make it an ecologically friendly toilet. So. And then again, we don't really design them for 60 people at once to jump off a bus and use them, but unfortunately that's what's happening with them, and it's probably overtaxing it a little bit to what it was originally intended for. Maintenance is pretty good because we've got crews that regularly patrol up and down the highways, and I think even now, if our crews did miss it, the travelling public is very much aware of the areas and they'd be pretty quick in reporting what they do see.
Wanda Robbins worked during the Second World War as a volunteer nurse at the Sydney Showground, treating wounded soldiers from the North African campaign. Wanda represents the War Widows Guild on the Remembrance Driveway Committee. She remembers a time when maintenance of the plantations was less of a problem.
The army used to supply the water. They used to have a water tank. We had an army chap who was very interested in the whole thing, and he used to authorise these chaps to go and water all these plants. But of course you can't do that now, because the water restrictions, number one, and you've really got to be at it all the time, because if you go down that main highway, some parts are so dry and barren, it'd take days of watering.
So have any of the plantations or groves or rest areas suffered as a result of the drought?
Yeah, they have. We've lost trees. But there's no good replanting till we can get the rain.
Now, I believe the RTA have been most helpful over the years.
They've been wonderful. Absolutely, yeah. I'd say we owe practically everything to the RTA.
What sort of things have they done for the driveway?
Well, they've financed us, which is a very big help, because we've had to employ different people to replant trees, and it all costs money. The RTA have been good there.
David Farquhar explains his concerns.
In general, the graves along the Hume Highway at Liverpool through to Chullora are generally looked after. The RTA look after them with their maintenance contract. They keep them mowed and do infilling. Unfortunately, when you come to commercial areas, we've had three or four occasions of problems with commercial operations infiltrating onto Remembrance Driveway land. The worst one, of course, is where the War Widows had a plantation opposite Warwick Farm Racecourse, where there's a shopping establishment, and they were complaining that all the trees were hiding the shopping establishment from purchasers, retailers. So over time, the trees disappeared, killed, you know. And so we've decided no point trying to fight them, because as much as we put plantings in there, they'll just be ripped out. That's the only site that have had real problems.
Leonie Knappman confirms.
They had just finished our freeway out here and the ramp where you come off into Mittagong, and they had all the beautiful, I think they were bottle brush, all planted. Anyway, they went out next day and the whole lot were gone. So somebody had decided that they would look better in their garden, I guess. And the whole lot were gone overnight.
We think the crab apples were stolen at Hughie Edwards out there, so... Beautiful blossoming tree. They look good, and I think we've lost those probably twice now.
Charlotte Webb points out.
The Remembrance Driveway has changed its emphasis. Where it was as a living war memorial, it has now moved beyond that. It's also part of our streetscape, part of our landscape. It has really taken on another dimension as it matures. As a living memorial, it's a living and continuing to grow memorial. It's not sort of, you know, something that was there once and been bypassed by a new road. It continues to adapt to the new conditions. My concerns are what happens to the old ones, because they do have very important social, historic and botanic significance, both to the communities here, along the route, and communities further afield. But I think it's very interesting in the Remembrance Driveway in that it's actually got involvement from two states and a territory, in that it's involved with New South Wales, going from Sydney down to Canberra, New South Wales and the ACT, and then we have the Mackay Plantation at the Yarra Interchange. And that was dedicated to Mackay in Queensland, because there the floods had come in and actually washed away their war memorial. So there we have the first time that someone who's actually interstate has come in and contributed to the Remembrance Driveway that doesn't have anything to do with them. And I think that's a very significant interest in what really is a significant war memorial.
Significant it might be, but it seems that most people still don't know much about Remembrance Driveway. Ian Calloway comments.
The biggest challenge that I could see would be to try and get public recognition of the driveway. Now, I was aware, talking to people who should have known better, that they didn't understand that the Remembrance Driveway existed. Some of them had seen the groves of trees around the Southern Highlands, but they thought that the whole project had fizzled out. They didn't realise it was an ongoing project. And people didn't seem to realise where the driveway went to. So I thought what we need to do is to advertise the presence of the driveway along the road and keep on reminding people this is a Remembrance Driveway. And we prevailed upon the RTA, and they, every distance sign, the kilometres to go, every 5K signs, now embraces the little logo, the little Remembrance Driveway tree logo. So you've got those every 5 kilometres alongside the road. You've got a fairly regular Remembrance Driveway Sydney to Canberra or Remembrance Driveway Canberra to Sydney signs up to remind people about them. And, of course, we've got the VC rest areas, which are a very significant reminder of what the driveway's about. And we've launched the website, and we find people are using the website, and I get requests for information about the driveway on, you know, children who are doing projects.
When it comes to the long-term future of Remembrance Driveway, once all the VC rest areas are completed, what will the ongoing role of the committee be?
The ongoing role will be to maintain the driveway to the standard it is, make certain that the maintenance of rest areas doesn't fall away, make certain the signs are replaced. If there are any other VC winners, make certain they're on it. Now, we're going to have to start doubling up in some of the larger rest areas. We're going to start to have two VCs on it in the one rest area. That's obvious.
Jim Wallace represents the RSL on the committee. He spent the post-war years in Japan with the occupation forces. It left a deep impression on him.
You know, we went up there as a bunch of angry young men for what they'd done to our POWs and everybody else, but when you got there and seen it, oh, gee, you realised that, you know, it wasn't them at all. It wasn't these soldiers or anybody else. It was just a fact of life. One of the things that happened was crook. All the big cities had all been levelled, all burnt out. Absolutely. It was wasteland.
What does Remembrance Driveway mean to you?
Oh, as the name suggests, like it commemorates the servicemen and women. I'm going to put the women in. That served during those conflicts from 1939 right up to the present day. That'll be the next thing, to remember the people of the present era. Oh, down in Canberra, just outside the War Memorial, the last stone that was dedicated down there, that goes as far as East Timor.
Colin Faraday was born in 1917. A public servant working in the Taxation Office and Treasury, he enlisted in the war in 1941 as a trainee RAAF pilot. He flew Wellington aircraft during the latter years of the war in the North Atlantic and North Africa, bombing coastal targets and enemy shipping. In 1980, Colin took an interest in the RAAF Association's memorial groves in Canberra. They had been established in 1967 and now form part of Remembrance Driveway. He and a group of volunteers erected a sandstone cairn in the groves to commemorate all those who served in the Royal Australian Air Force during World War II.
It took them about 10 years to build that cairn. They used to go out there and spend their weekends, and I'd say there'd be about 150 trees planted there. And I think we're very proud of those trees. We think we're perhaps more in tune now than ever before with the idea of having a living memorial. We like the idea of these trees being there. The Snowy Mountains planted a number of them for us, and a number of those were stolen, but the Canberra Airport Authority came and replanted the trees for us. The response from all the different units that have served at Fairbairn and in other places, the fact that they all seem to appreciate, or they seem to be so happy to have a quiet place where they can go out at their leisure, perhaps have a little gathering of their people, spend a few minutes there every so often. And I'm so pleased that we've now got about 25 different units with plaques out there on our grove. I'm starting to appreciate the keenness, the thoughts of all the different people. See, it's not only aircrew, but I think now much more about all the different ones who've helped and who've risked their lives in different ways. The apprentices, the WAF ladies, they're coming there in their later years as keen as mustard. And I'm so pleased that we've been able to provide, or help to provide, a spot where they can come and remember their friends and others that they've flown with or worked with.
A former engineer with the RAAF, Group Captain Arthur Skimmon is the Vice President of the RAAF Association ACT Division. He has formulated some plans to beautify the groves.
We've come up with the idea with the National Capital Authority of putting historical plaques throughout the walkways that we've had constructed, and those plaques tell a history to people of another time where people were called upon to do more things than perhaps the next generation or the one after that will ever be asked to do. So it is a special place to the veterans, and it's not so much a special place to the veterans, it's now becoming a special place to the families of the veterans, and we're getting the second and third generation, we've got grandmothers and grandfathers, we've got grandchildren coming in. Each time we gather out there, we can have from 300, 350 people, 180, 110, down to the smaller groups, perhaps 60 to 30. In the last 6 months, we've been virtually out there every second weekend with some sort of dedication or commemoration of a plaque.
Interest in the RAAF Groves has spread beyond the veterans to the wider ACT community.
The University of Canberra landscape design students showed an interest in understanding the concept of landscape planting in the Remembrance Driveway, and they've been undertaking a study of the history of the original plantings and looking at ways to improve the appearance of the groves in the ACT to make them more appealing visually to the public, and to link them with public walkways so that instead of having to be driven by a motor car, that you can move from one grove to the next grove through a public walkway or a walking trail or bike trail. But we saw that that also opened itself up. It let another group of tertiary qualified people have an understanding of what the symbolism is of the design, original landscape design of the Remembrance Driveway. So much so that we actually created a website, and all this detail is available now on a website that we've put together, and we're slowly updating it and expanding that website. That website will also be picked up, and it's linked to the Australian War Memorial, and it's also will be linked to the new Royal Australian Air Force Association national website, so that people will be able to access it, to the history and the knowledge of Remembrance Driveway through the websites.
What do you think is the future for Remembrance Driveway?
I think the Remembrance Driveway has taken a good move in developing the VC rest areas, in reopening, re-exposing the plantations and their whole scheme to a new general public, the motorist. It's created service areas. Again, it's still the experiential landscape. That's what people are going there for, but they're also going for service as well. So they're moving and meeting the demands, I think, of the motorist.
Sally Kalina concludes.
I was writing out my usual president's report a few years ago for the Garden Club of Australia, just to mention places I've visited, what we're doing with the Remembrance Driveway. And my sister is a very bright woman, and we're thinking of some line to put in a nutshell about the Remembrance Driveway. And we said this, we penned this out. The Remembrance Driveway is a living tribute for those who remember yesterday, and for those who have given us our tomorrow. And I think it puts it in just a short sentence what we are about.
The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent, in whole or in part, the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority. In recent years, a number of rest areas along the Remembrance Driveway between Sydney and Canberra have been dedicated to the recipients of the Victoria Cross. The Remembrance Driveway itself and these rest areas serve to remind travellers of the sacrifices made by members of the Australian Defence Forces in World War II and subsequent conflicts. This CD contains brief descriptions of rest areas encountered during the southbound trip between Sydney and Canberra, and a brief background to the circumstances which led to the awarding of the Victoria Cross. Anthony Staunton is a Canberra-based historian who has researched and written about VC winners. Born in Melbourne in 1948, he found his interest in the subject stimulated at primary school.
I can pick when I got my interest in history in the Victoria Cross. It was my grade 3 teacher, and he was talking about the 7 Victoria Crosses awarded at Lone Pine on Gallipoli. And I didn't quite understand how there were 2,000 killed, but only 7 got the Victoria Cross. Brother O'Loughlin was the teacher. He's now in South Australia. And the interesting thing about him is that I believe he influenced most of my brothers to barrack for Essendon. But he influenced me to be interested in history and the Victoria Cross. And I did history at university. And I've continued, I've been a member of the Military Historical Society for 30 years. The reason why I got into it was I found that people were most interested in the subject, but not much was being done on research, and I got great joy in, you know, fixing up details, correcting typos, and having a good overview of all the Australian recipients plus all the worldwide recipients. The Victoria Cross arose out of the Crimean War. The idea was first officially mooted by the Duke of Newcastle. However, a member of the House of Commons, a Captain Scobell, raised the issue in late 1854. The Duke of Newcastle approached Prince Albert, who was now enthusiastic for the proposal, and the stage was set. It was first announced in the House of Lords that there would be a cross of merit or an order of merit for all ranks, and this eventually became the Victoria Cross. First promulgated in 1856, the first awards announced in 1857. In all, 111 awards were gazetted for the Crimean War. The first presentation of 62 recipients took place in Hyde Park in June of 1857. Two of the soldiers who missed out belonged to the 77th Middlesex Regiment, Sergeant Park and Private Wright. And so they received their awards in a private ceremony in Sydney in March of 1858. They were the first Victoria Cross recipients decorated in Australia. In all, 40 men have received their VC in Australia, 2 British Army, 1 Royal Navy, and 37 members of the Australian Defence Forces. The last two being Ray Simpson and Keith Payne, from the Queen during her visit to Australia in 1970.
Remembrance Driveway begins on the Hume Highway, which is named after the explorer Hamilton Hume. The Partridge VC rest area was established in 2004 and is located on the Hume Highway 2 kilometres south of Moreton Park Road.
Frank John Partridge was awarded the last Victoria Cross to an Australian in the Second World War. It actually was also the last awarded to an army recipient in the Second World War. In July of 1945, as the 8th Australian Battalion advanced in North Bougainville, the first ridge was reached without opposition. But as they approached the second ridge, Partridge was wounded twice. Grabbing a Bren gun from a dead Australian soldier, he gave it to one of his men and said, "You provide covering fire and I'll go and attack the post." Grabbing a grenade, he destroyed the first post. He then moved on to a second post, which he knocked out, but then fainted through loss of blood. Less than 2 weeks later, active patrolling in Bougainville ceased, and 3 weeks later, the war was over. He'd been born in 1924, so when he was awarded the Victoria Cross, he was just 20 years old. He was therefore not of age and therefore could not, without his parents' permission, join the AIF. And so had the distinction of being the only militia soldier to be awarded the Victoria Cross in the Second World War. As well as being a successful radio and TV quiz champion, he was also a successful banana farmer. And sadly, he was killed in a car accident, aged just 40, leaving a wife and a child.
A short distance from the now-bypassed township of Berrima is the Mackay VC rest area. It is located 400 metres south of Black Bob's Creek, where one can find the oldest existing unreinforced concrete road bridge in New South Wales, built in 1896 and remaining in service until 1971. The Mackay VC rest area was established by the Remembrance Driveway Committee in 2001.
John Bernard Mackay was the only pioneer awarded the Victoria Cross in the Second World War. Of the 17 awards to the Army, one went to the artillery, to Sir Roden Cutler, 15 to the infantry, and one to the pioneers. He was born in 1922 in Leichhardt, educated at the Christian Brothers Lewisham, became an apprentice to his father, who was a baker, and worked in Sydney before joining the AIF. He served in the Middle East and returned with the 9th Division to Australia in February of 1943. The 2nd 3rd Pioneer Battalion was attached to the 26th Brigade of the 9th Division, which assaulted Tarakan on the 1st of May 1945. And 12 days later, Mackay was on a feature known as Helen, a narrow spur on a very steep razorback hill. His platoon came under heavy fire. Mackay took the initiative, attacked the first Japanese position, a light machine gun, and in hand-to-hand combat, destroyed the Japanese. With grenades, he crept forward and took out a heavy machine gun. Grabbing an Owen gun, he charged towards the 3rd position and was killed. The Victoria Cross was presented to his sister, Pat, and later on the medal was presented at the Australian War Memorial, where it is today.
The next VC rest area, 2 kilometres south of Sally's Corner Road and the Shoal Service Station, is that of Kingsbury VC. It was dedicated in 1995.
During the Second World War, 10 Victoria Crosses were awarded for gallantry in what is now Papua New Guinea. The first award was to Bruce Steele Kingsbury and was one of the two awards in Papua, but the only award for the Kokoda Trail. The Japanese had been attacking the 2nd 14th Battalion, and Kingsbury had been, with other members of the headquarters and signal platoon, sent to reinforce the companies under attack. The platoon had most of the members killed or wounded. The Japanese attacks continued and were in danger of breaking through the Australian lines. Under severe machine gun fire, Kingsbury, using a Bren gun, attacked the Japanese, halted the attack, and shortly afterwards was killed by a sniper. This is August of 1942, and he became the first Australian to be awarded the Victoria Cross on Australian territory. He died defending Australia.
The Derrick VC rest area is located 300 metres south of Carrick Road at Tauranga. There is a stone arch bridge and several culverts over Tauranga Creek adjacent to the parking space of the VC rest area, built by convicts of the nearby Tauranga stockade. The Derrick VC rest area was dedicated in 1999.
If the great Australian hero of the First World War was Albert Jacka, the great Australian hero of the Second World War was Thomas Currie Derrick. who was awarded the Victoria Cross in New Guinea in 1943, having previously been awarded a Distinguished Conduct Medal in the desert in 1942. He was born in South Australia, and in the Depression he moved to Berry, where he got work as a fruit picker and then full-time work later on a farm. When war broke out, he joined the 2nd 48th Battalion and became the fourth member of that battalion to be awarded the Victoria Cross. In November of 1944, as the Australians moved towards Saddleburg, the enemy position was so strong that the order was given to withdraw. However, Derrick approached his commanding officer and requested one last attempt. With grenades, he managed to knock out one post. In all, on an extraordinary day, he, with the help of his platoon, managed to knock out 10 Japanese posts, and the following morning, the Japanese, demoralised, withdrew from Saddleburg. At 10 a.m. on the morning that the village was taken, the Australian flag was raised by Derrick. And that photograph has been used in many ways since. As well as serving in the Middle East before returning to the Pacific, he continued in 1944 to do officer training and was commissioned a lieutenant. Still with his battalion, he went to Tarakan in 1945, and again showing great distinction, he was mortally wounded. He is buried at Labuan Cemetery in Malaysia. He was one of the finest fighting soldiers of the Second World War.
The next rest area is that of Kibi VC, 2 kilometres south of the Federal Highway turnoff from the Hume Highway near Stillwater Road. It is close to the property where Miles Franklin wrote her famous book, My Brilliant Career. The Kibi VC rest area was established in 1996.
William Henry Kibbe is one of the extraordinary Victoria Cross recipients of the Second World War. Born in England, in Durham, in 1903, he came with his parents to Australia in 1914. They settled in South Australia. He had joined the AIF in 1940, at the age 37, served throughout the Siege of Tobruk, and was awarded the Victoria Cross for 3 separate actions during the Battle of Al Alamein of 1942. Kibbe was outstanding on the first night of the battle of the 23rd of October. The Australians moved forward, however, the minefields and the German positions were much deeper than expected. And when no breakthrough occurred, one of the most extraordinary things of the whole battle, which continued on until the 5th of November, was that Montgomery, the 8th Army commander, needed to replan and relaunch his attack. And he needed time in order to do that. And the time was gained by the 9th Australian Division. So instead of attacking into the desert, they attacked towards the coast with the aim of drawing in the German reinforcements, which it successfully did. On the night of the 30th, 31st of October, a further attack was made. Kibbe was in the fore again, but this time was killed. He's buried at the Al Alamein War Cemetery.
The John Edmondson VC rest area is situated 16 kilometres south of the Federal Highway turnoff. It overlooks Rose Lagoon, a favourite haunt of bushrangers in the 1860s who bailed up many an unsuspecting traveller. The John Edmondson VC rest area was dedicated in 1995.
John Edmondson was born in Wagga Wagga. He was the first Victoria Cross recipient of the Second World War, and his award was in the opening days of the Siege of Tobruk. The Australian 9th Division had replaced the 6th Division, which had gone to Greece, and was expecting, say, a couple of months of preparation before it would be in serious action. But Rommel changed the plan. The Australians withdrew into Tobruk, And several days after the siege began, the Germans mounted a large scale attack. But just before the attack, the Germans attacked Post R-33, which was manned by men of the 2nd 17th New South Wales Battalion. A patrol led by Lieutenant Mackerel, Corporal Edmondson, and five other men went out to regain a position. During the fighting, Edmondson was injured. However, despite his injuries, when Mackerel got into difficulties with a German, he came to his rescue and saved the life of Lieutenant Mackerel. They took the injured Edmondson back to their original position, but sadly he passed away. The Victoria Cross was presented to his parents and now resides in the Hall of Valour in the Australian War Memorial.
One of several rest areas along Lake George, the Peter John Badcoe VC rest area is located 16 kilometres south of the northern turnoff to Collector. Lake George is Australia's largest inland freshwater lake. In times gone by, the lake was used for boating and recreation, but it can also be a treacherous body of water in which people have drowned. At other times, the lake dries out to become a huge empty paddock. The Badcoe VC rest area was dedicated in 1998.
Artillery major for most of his career, Badcoe was the second of the four Australian Victoria Cross recipients for Vietnam. Decorated for three acts of bravery in February, March and April of 1967. On the first occasion, he heard over the radio of a wounded American advisor. Under heavy fire, he rushed to his aid and saved his life. 2 weeks later, the Viet Cong were attacking a South Vietnamese unit, and again, Badcoe rushed to their aid, led them into the counterattack, and prevented the Viet Cong taking the position. On the 7th of April, the South Vietnamese were again attacking, but were held up by heavy fire. Badcoe again took the lead. With grenades, he was attacking the Viet Cong positions, but when he again rose to throw a grenade, he was hit and killed. The Victoria Cross was given for all three incidents. It was one of the rare occasions where the Victoria Cross is given for multiple incidents at different and widely spaced occasions. He was a real enthusiast, really loved the military, was very keen to see action, got transferred to the Australian Army training team, and when in action, he gained the great respect of both the South Vietnamese and the Americans who he worked alongside. He left a wife and three daughters, and the Victoria Cross was presented by his widow to the Australian War Memorial.
The Wheatley VC rest area, established in 1998, is 19 kilometres south of the northern turnoff to Collector.
Warrant Officer Class 2, Kevin Arthur Wheatley, Dasher Wheatley as many knew him, was the first of four Australians decorated with the Victoria Cross in Vietnam.
Warrant Officer Wheatley found himself in a situation. He was in Vietnam with his company he was leading were South Vietnamese, and one of his fellow Australian warrant officers was wounded. They were in the middle of a fight, and Warrant Officer Wheatley could have retreated with the rest of his troops, but he elected to stay with his injured mate and made certain that he didn't die alone. He made certain he wasn't captured by the North Vietnamese, and he died with him. I find that absolutely amazing.
This story of self-sacrifice was awarded the Victoria Cross. However, the Australian Army was not sure as to whether or not such self-sacrifice was eligible for the Victoria Cross, and sought advice from the authorities in England as to whether or not it was an appropriate case for a Victoria Cross. A recommendation was forwarded to Buckingham Palace. The reply from England was that this was a most appropriate case. He was a great character. He was a great sportsman. He had a few party tricks. He was a fair dinkum Australian and a brave soldier. His Victoria Cross is now also on display at the Australian War Memorial. It's worth mentioning that the Australian War Memorial has the largest public collection of Victoria Crosses on display in the world.
The Payne VC rest area is yet to be dedicated, but it is envisaged that it will be co-located with the existing Wheatley VC rest area. Payne received his Victoria Cross for actions in the Vietnam War in May of 1969.
Keith Payne was the fourth Australian awarded the Victoria Cross in the Vietnam War. He also was the last Australian recipient of the Victoria Cross under the Imperial Honours System. Australia now has its own Australian Honours System with new gallantry decorations. Keith Payne was wounded when the enemy attacked his company of Vietnamese troops. The Vietnamese faltered. Payne rallied the troops. However, the order was given to withdraw and he withdrew them to a position. But at night time, he went back to go and find troops who'd been cut off and brought them back to the new positions. Despite his wounds, despite the terrible conditions, he was able to show the great leadership and courage for which he was awarded the Victoria Cross. I'm pleased to say I've met him on several occasions. He's been most gracious and he's now retired.
The Newton VC rest area, located not far from the historic towns of Bylong and Bungendore to the south, was set up in 1997. It is 300 metres south of the Shingle Hill Way and the turn off to Gundaroo, above the southern end of Lake George.
William Alice Newton was the only Australian airman awarded the Victoria Cross in the Pacific. Indeed, of the four Australian airmen awarded the Victoria Cross, his was the only award while serving with a Royal Australian Air Force squadron. It was also the only award for the Salamaua campaign, which occurred after the Japanese had been defeated in Papua and before the invasion of the Huron Peninsula. Newton had been born in St Kilda in 1919 and had been educated at the Melbourne Church of England Grammar School. He was well regarded by his teachers, who regarded him as having leadership ability. He was a tall man, 6'3" or 191 centimetres. He was a fine cricketer and played one game at representative level for Victoria against New South Wales. He joined the Royal Australian Air Force and was such a fine pilot that he was kept training for quite some time. He eventually was posted to New Guinea, flying Bostons. He flew 52 operations. Many of the operations he came under anti-aircraft fire. On the 16th of March, he attacked Salamaua, suffered damage to his aircraft from the heavy anti-aircraft fire. He went in quite low to destroy his target, and 2 days later, he was back attacking Salamaua again. This time, the aircraft was forced down, crashed at sea, and Newton and one of his crew managed to escape, but were immediately captured by the Japanese. The Japanese sentenced both men to death. Both were beheaded, and for some time after the war, the photograph of an Australian being executed, which was circulated during the war, was thought to be Newton. However, it turned out to be an army officer. After the war, his body was recovered, and he was buried in Lae War Cemetery.
The Huey Edwards VC rest area, established in 2000, is 9 kilometres south of Max Reef Road in the Federal Highway off-ramp to Cooma. The rest area incorporates the RAAF Association's Memorial Groves. To return to the highway, proceed along Horse Park Drive and turn right at the intersection, then left onto the loading ramp back to the Federal Highway with the green sign to Canberra.
Huey Edwards joined the Australian Army in the mid-1930s, and about a year later he transferred to the Royal Australian Air Force, and after he graduated as a pilot, he transferred to the Royal Air Force. So while an Australian, he actually was awarded the Victoria Cross as a member of the Royal Air Force, but we still call him an Aussie. During the war, he commanded 105 Squadron of the Royal Air Force. In June of 1941, he was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. The following month, he made a low-level attack on Bremen, Germany. This attack was carried out under very heavy fire. He was under German flak attack for about 10 minutes. His aircraft was hit 20 times. He managed to successfully bomb his target and then bring most of his aircraft back to England, and he was awarded the Victoria Cross. The following December, he led another attack on the Philips radio factory at Eindhoven in Holland and was awarded the Distinguished Service Order and became the first airman in the Second World War to be awarded the Victoria Cross, the Distinguished Service Order and the Distinguished Flying Cross. He was being sent in to do something quite extraordinary, low-level daylight attacks against heavy enemy fire. I think that he carried out his orders in a brilliant manner, which was recognised. However, I think it was also recognised that this was not the way to conduct a bombing campaign, and the main bombing campaign for the rest of the war by the Royal Air Force was night bombing. He continued in the Royal Air Force after the war, having a number of distinguished appointments. After he retired from the Royal Air Force, he returned to Australia, and in 1974-1975, he was Governor of Western Australia, but ill health forced him to resign. He died in 1982, and his widow presented his medals to the Australian War Memorial.
At Remembrance Park in Canberra, behind the Australian War Memorial in Limestone Avenue, is a cannon plaque marking the end of the Remembrance driveway. The park has four VC dedications. The first is that of Kelleher VC, dedicated in 2002.
Richard Kelleher was an Irishman. He was born in County Kerry in 1910. He had come to Australia as a young man and had joined the AIF when war broke out. In September 1943, when the 2nd 25th Battalion was advancing towards Ley, his platoon was badly hit by enemy fire. A number were killed and wounded, and his section commander was trapped by enemy fire. Kelleher said, "I better go and bring him out." Grabbing some grenades, he went towards the enemy and attacked the Japanese positions. He then went back and grabbed a Bren gun and put further fire, knocking out the Japanese position. Still under heavy fire, he went forward and rescued his section commander. Most unusually, as well as Kelleher being awarded the Victoria Cross, the section commander was also awarded the Military Medal. I don't recall another situation where both the rescuer and the rescued were both decorated for gallantry. He was a slight man, very good-natured. However, he had run into difficulties when he had first gone to New Guinea on the Kokoda Trail. After arriving back in Australia, he was court-martialed for desertion. He had a different view. He said he'd come back under orders, but regrettably the officer who had ordered him back with a message had been killed. The army authorities reviewed the file and quashed the sentence. After he was awarded the Victoria Cross, he said, "There were some misunderstandings of my motives, but I soon retained the regard of my battalion. But I always look for an opportunity to show that I did not lack courage."
Also established in 2002 at Remembrance Park is the Ratty VC rest area.
Reginald Roy Ratty was the first of two Australians awarded the Victoria Cross on the island of Bougainville in 1945. However, it should be remembered that a Victoria Cross had been posthumously awarded to a Fijian soldier on Bougainville serving with the Americans the previous year. Ratty was a member of the 25th Battalion of the 3rd Australian Division. The 25th Battalion was a militia unit, although many of the militia units, when they got the required number of AIF volunteers, became AIF units. Ratty had originally been a militia man, had volunteered for the AIF, but served throughout the war with the 25th Battalion. In March of 1945, the Japanese put up severe resistance in the area of Slater's Knoll on the Boone Road in South Bougainville. The actions for a number of days swung back and forth. During an Australian attack, Ratty led his section with Bren gun firing against successive Japanese weapon pits. His individual action enabled the Australians to advance and avoid casualties. His great gallantry on occasion was recognised by the Victoria Cross. Born in New South Wales in 1918, a keen sportsman, he had worked on his parents' property in the West Wyalong district. After the war, he returned to the West Wyalong district, where he remained for the rest of his life. He remains today buried in the Lawn Cemetery at West Wyalong.
The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent, in whole or in part, the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority. In recent years, a number of rest areas along the Remembrance Driveway between Sydney and Canberra have been dedicated to recipients of the Victoria Cross. The Remembrance Driveway itself and these rest areas serve to remind travellers of the sacrifices made by members of the Australian Defence Forces in World War II and subsequent conflicts. This CD contains brief descriptions of rest areas encountered during the northbound trip between Canberra and Sydney and a brief background to the circumstances which led to the awarding of the Victoria Cross. The Simpson VC Memorial is also located at Remembrance Park in the ACT and was dedicated in 2005.
Ray Simpson was the third Australian VC recipient of the Vietnam War. He was cited for two acts of gallantry on the 6th and the 11th of May 1969. On the first occasion, leading a company of Vietnamese, they came under fire. Many were hit, and another Australian advisor was wounded. Simpson rescued the Australian advisor under fire, then rallied his men so that all the men could withdraw in order. 5 days later, when the battalion attacked again, the American battalion commander was killed. Another Australian advisor was injured, and the Vietnamese were demoralised. Simpson again rescued the Australian under fire, rallied the Vietnamese troops, and enabled the men to withdraw to safety. Ray Simpson may have the record of the longest service in the Australian Army for a Victoria Cross recipient. After the Second World War, he left the army for a brief period, but when Korea came, he rejoined and saw service in Korea, saw service in Malaya, and in 1962, he was one of the first group of Australians sent to Vietnam. After his first tour of Vietnam, he went back for a second tour in July of 1964. During that service, he was awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal. Leaving the army eventually, he retired to Japan, having met and married a Japanese woman in 1952. He died of cancer in 1978 and was still working as an administrative assistant at the Australian Embassy in Tokyo. He was survived by his wife.
Remembrance Park is also home to the Stasevich VC Memorial, dedicated in December 2005.
Private Leslie Thomas Stasevich was the sixth member of the 9th Australian Division decorated with the Victoria Cross. The 9th Division landed at Labuan Island in June of 1945 and then moved on to the mainland. On the 27th of June, the battalion had moved into the town of Beaufort, but the Japanese had counter-attacked, isolating an Australian company. Another Australian company was ordered to go to the rescue. Stasevich was one of the members of the company, and as they moved along the track, he was confronted by two Japanese machine gun posts. He systematically assaulted each post, knocking them out, and then moved on, where he encountered a third post, which again, showing great initiative and gallantry, he assaulted, killing all the Japanese. The Australian company was relieved, and shortly afterwards, Japanese resistance in that area ceased. Born in Subiaco, West Australia, in 1918, he joined the AIF in 1941. He went overseas in 1941, but by the time he got to the Middle East, the 9th Division was out of Tobruk and was in Syria. However, he went with the 9th Division to Egypt in July to resist the German attacks and was wounded on the 17th of July. However, he recovered and had rejoined his unit for the Battle of Al Alamein and then returned with the 9th Division to Australia in February of 1943. He also saw some heavy fighting in September 1943, and it was in North Borneo that he was awarded the Victoria Cross.
Middleton VC is the first rest area after leaving Canberra. Located 200 metres north of the Bungendore Road turnoff, it was dedicated in 1997.
The citation for Rawdon Hugh Middleton ends with this dedication. His devotion to duty in the face of overwhelming odds is unsurpassed in the annals of the Royal Air Force. Middleton was a member of the Royal Australian Air Force who was attached to the Royal Air Force. I know of no other tribute in a Victoria Cross citation which expresses it that well. He was on his 29th sortie. The normal tour of duties was 30 missions. He was flying a Stirling bomber. His gunners had all completed 30 missions and had decided to stay with their captain until he had finished his last two sorties. On the outward trip, the plane had difficulty flying over the Alps. The target was Turin in Italy. He flew over the target but was hit by flak. A shell splinter ruined his right eye socket. He was knocked unconscious and the second pilot took over, but he also had been wounded. Middleton regained consciousness and sent his second pilot and other crew members to get some medical attention, and he took back controls of the aircraft. He decided to make for the English Channel so that his crew could bail out. He knew he would not be able to get back to land the aircraft. For 4 hours he flew his aircraft. He got to the English Channel and was on the English side with 5 minutes to spare when 5 of the 7 crew members were able to exit. He turned the aircraft back to the sea to land at sea, but he and 2 others were killed. His body was washed ashore some days later and he was given a full military funeral in England. An extraordinary postscript to this story was that one of the 5 crewmen who survived was RAF Sergeant Donald Cameron. 2 years later, he was ordered to again bail out from an injured aircraft. This aircraft was flown by Ian Bazalgette of the Royal Air Force. He made a forced landing and was also posthumously awarded the Victoria Cross.
The Anderson VC rest area, dedicated in 1999, is located 7 kilometres north of the Bungendore Road turnoff.
The only Australian awarded the Victoria Cross in the Malayan campaign was Charles Groves Wright Anderson, commanding officer of the 2nd 19th Battalion. He was decorated for his gallantry in 4 days in the Battle of the Moore River in mid-January of 1942. He was with the headquarters acting as brigade major of the 45th Indian Brigade when the headquarters were shelled. Everyone was killed except for Anderson and the commanding officer, who was injured. Anderson took command of the brigade, which had 2 Australian battalions and 2 Indian battalions. All of them were under heavy attack. He eventually got all the battalions together and decided to try and fight their way through because the Japanese had surrounded and cut off their withdrawal points. Anderson at one stage led a counterattack to try and break through. He attacked Japanese positions. However, by the last day, all hope of breaking through had gone, and he gave the order for the men to break into little groups and to make their own way back to Johor and then to Singapore. All the battalions suffered severe losses, and shortly before the surrender, he actually was awarded the Victoria Cross. He spent 3.5 years as a prisoner of war and was repatriated to Australia. Distinguished in 2 World Wars, he's the only Australian Victoria Cross recipient who was decorated with gallantry awards in both World Wars. He actually had been born in South Africa and had served in the First World War in East Africa with the South African forces and had been awarded the Military Cross. Came to Australia in the mid-1930s. And had joined the militia in the late 30s and was appointed 2nd in command of the 2nd 19th Battalion, and eventually by the time of the Japanese attack he was commanding officer of that unit. After the war he returned to the land. He served 3 terms in Parliament for the seat of Hume. He lived his last few years in Canberra. Anderson died on the 11th of November 1988, an appropriate date for a First World War soldier, aged 91. A full military funeral was held at Manuka, and I particularly remember his medals being on his casket after the service.
The Gurney VC rest area, established in 1995, is 20 kilometres north of the Bungendore Road turnoff.
Arthur Stanley Gurney was the first of 4 members of the 2nd 48th Battalion to receive the Victoria Cross. He had joined the AIF in 1940 and joined his battalion in the last days that it was in Tobruk before it was withdrawn in September of 1940. After retraining and re-equipping in Palestine, the 9th Division was called upon to help stem the German advance into Egypt in July of 1942. On 22nd of July, the 2nd 48th Battalion was attacking along the coast. The battalion was held up and Gurney took the initiative, charged the first machine gun post, knocked it out, charged a 2nd machine gun post and silenced it, and was killed as he was attacking a 3rd machine gun post. It was the first posthumous award to an Australian in the Second World War, although sadly many of the other awards were posthumous. He had been a professional cyclist prior to the war and had been employed with the electricity and gas department in Perth. I remember when his Victoria Cross was presented to the War Memorial. I actually attended the presentation and was quite honoured to do so.
I think it's interesting that, I mean, obviously as part of a division, a unit, a platoon, soldiers are trained to work in with each other, to complement each other, to work in as a team, and yet here are VC winners who suddenly, for the action they've taken, are standing out from the pack.
But they're doing it for their mates. They don't do it for ideology. They don't do it for the glory. They see that this is the only way that
they can save their men or save their platoon when, as so often happens in a military situation, things go wrong.
The Kenner VC rest area is yet to be dedicated, but it is intended to be located at the large plantation area, which includes the present Gurney VC rest area at Lake George North.
Edward Kenner was the second member of the 6th Australian Division decorated with the Victoria Cross. His gallantry occurred at Wewak in New Guinea on the 15th of May 1945. It was a typical platoon scene. The gun section moved to the right to provide covering fire. The rest of the platoon moved to the left to assault the Japanese positions. When Kenner got into position, he saw that there was nowhere that he could place his Bren gun to provide covering fire because of the high grass. So, on his own initiative, without orders, he stood up in full view of the enemy and with his Bren gun provided covering fire for his platoon mates attacking the Japanese. When he ran out of ammunition, he grabbed the rifle and kept firing. Bullets whizzed close to him. He then grabbed another Bren gun and kept firing at the enemy. His great gallantry in exposing himself caused to demoralise the Japanese and the Australians took the position. Several weeks later, he was wounded in the face and was hospitalised. In 1947, he married one of the nurses who had nursed him at Heidelberg Repatriation Hospital. A great gentleman, we're most honoured that he's still with us. The only Australian recipient living from the Second World War, one of just 9 World War II surviving VC recipients worldwide.
The rest area 400 metres north of the turnoff to Collector is that of Percival Eric Gratwick VC. It was established in 1996.
Gratwick was another of the members of the 2nd 48th Battalion awarded the Victoria Cross. With Kibbe, he was also decorated for Al Alamein. Born in Western Australia in 1902, he'd been a gold prospector before the war. He also joined his unit in Tobruk in 1941, shortly before the battalion returned to Syria for rest and retraining. On the night of the 25th, 26th of October, his platoon was attacking on the left when it came under severe enemy fire. His platoon commander, his platoon sergeant, and most of the men of the platoon were killed or wounded. There were just 7 men remaining. Gratwick seized the initiative. He attacked the first machine gun post, seized the second machine gun post, and was attacking a third machine gun post when he was killed. He also is buried at Al Alamein War Cemetery. He was a reasonably tall man, medium built, a practical joker, a bachelor, but he loved children. He was a bushman who thought that city people were a profit and lost people. I think it was lost, not lost.
The French VC rest area, located close to the village of Yarra, was set up in 1996. It is 3 kilometres north of the Federal Highway interchange with the Hume Highway.
John Alexander French was one of the 2 Victoria Cross recipients for Papua. The Japanese had attacked Milne Bay in late August 1942, and the 2nd 9th Battalion of the 18th Brigade, with a militia brigade, was there to resist. On the 4th of September, about 3 miles east of KV Mission, French's platoon was attacking but was held up by 3 enemy machine gun posts. French told his men to take cover and, taking grenades, he stalked the first machine gun post, which he knocked out. He returned for more grenades and took out the second machine gun post. And then, with a Thompson submachine gun, he attacked the 3rd post, but was killed in front of the 3rd gun pit. He had been born in Toowoomba, educated in Toowoomba, and had joined his father's tobacconist and barber business at Crow's Nest. He was unmarried, but had a fiancée who said that he would always do his duty and wouldn't worry about his safety. A few days after French was killed, the Japanese had been completely defeated in the Milne Bay area, and Australia had secured its first complete victory against the Japanese in the Second World War.
The Chowne VC Rest Area, established in 1997, is 5 kilometres north of Carrick Road on the Hume Highway.
Lieutenant Albert Chowne was a member of the 2nd Australian Battalion, a unit of the 6th Australian Division. Although the 6th Division had been in many campaigns since 1940, this was the first Victoria Cross awarded to the division during the Second World War. On the 25th of March 1945, Chowne's platoon was in reserve when another platoon attacked along a narrow ridge. They came under heavy fire. The platoon commander was wounded. Chowne saw the flight of the 1st Platoon. Leading his men, he made a frontal charge at the Japanese position. He was wounded but kept going and killed 2 enemy soldiers. His actions overran the Japanese position, allowed the Australians to advance and saved further casualties. However, he died of his wounds. He was posthumously awarded the Victoria Cross. Born in Sydney in 1920, he was educated in the Willoughby area. He was a great football, tennis and scouting member. He had joined the AIF in 1940. His battalion, the 2nd 13th, was the only Australian battalion which was not relieved and served throughout the 242-day siege in Tobruk. After Tobruk, the battalion rested in Syria. He then went to Egypt in July of 1942. He was wounded on the first night of the Battle of Al Alamein, but recovered in order to return to Australia with the 9th Australian Division in early 1943.
The Gordon VC Rest Area on the Hume Highway was set up in 2001 and is 6 kilometres north of the Illawarra Highway turnoff.
James Gordon was the other recipient for the Syrian campaign, the other one being Sir Roden Cutler. He was a member of the 2nd 31st Battalion of the 7th Australian Division. Born in Rockingham, Western Australia in 1909, he had worked at Gingin in Perth before the war. In July of 1941, just before the armistice, the company was tasked at attacking a position known as Greenhill. They were met by heavy fire, casualties occurred, and Gordon took the initiative to attack the machine gun posts, knocking out and preventing further casualties and taking the position. He stayed in the army after the war, and then worked at Swanbourne Barracks as a caretaker after leaving the army. I remember meeting him in the early 1980s when he came over to an Anzac Day march in Melbourne, and one of the few times I've actually walked up to a Victoria Cross recipient and asked for his autograph. I was quite struck by what a modest person he was and how gracious he was in giving his autograph, which he must have done many times before. He died in Western Australia in 1986 at the age of 77. I felt it was a great honour to have actually met him.
In November 2006, close to Remembrance Day, the M7-M5 interchange in southwestern Sydney was dedicated in honour of Sir Roden Cutler VC. A commemorative plaque and rest area were provided in a nearby recreation area in Ash Road, Prestons, which has an excellent view of the interchange.
Sir Roden Cutler is probably the most distinguished and the most known Australian recipient of the Second World War. He was an artilleryman and was the only Australian artilleryman of either World War to be awarded the Victoria Cross. He was one of the 2 recipients of the Syrian campaign. The Australians went into Syria in June of 1941. He was quite a long citation. He was cited for gallantry earlier in the campaign when, as a observation party, he went forward almost behind enemy lines where he was able to signal in the Australian artillery. The group was attacked. Sir Roden actually manned a anti-tank gun and fired at the tracks of a tank and caused it to withdraw. Later on in the campaign, he was wounded and had to be carried out of action. He was actually out in no man's land for some time, and to save his life, they had to amputate his leg.
Sir Roden Cutler, recorded in 1995, explains why he enlisted and the circumstances leading to the awarding of his Victoria Cross.
It was war. We'd joined up because we felt that it was necessary to stop the rampage that was ravaging Europe and threatening Australia. We did our duty as we saw it, and I suppose some were lucky or unlucky enough to be in a position at a time when they had to do something. I suppose that I was in that position. It started with me returning from an area where I'd been seeing that the guns were brought down and repositioned, and the CO said to me, "Look, we don't know where Captain Clark is. Will you go up and find him?" So I went up and eventually found Captain Clark, and we got caught by about 15 foreign legionnaires and two light tanks in an old broken down mud hut, and they attacked us. Clark was killed, Bren Gunner next to me was killed, the signaller with me was wounded. I was fortunate enough to survive, and then the question arose as to whether we should withdraw. We were on the fringe of Merjeun, the town, and it was an essential town to be held if we were to stay there. Otherwise, we would have been driven back into Palestine. So I argued that we should press on. It should be an advance. The enemy were unsure, and so I pushed ahead with about five other ranks to set up an observation post to register the guns on the only road which ran into the town. I left four of the men at a house on the fringe of the town and pressed on with the signaller where I could get a good view of the road. I had just finished registering the road when a heavy tank came up, stopped, I suppose, no more than 20 yards from me, but down at a lower level, so they didn't see me, fortunately, and I crawled into a drainage ditch and said to, on the phone, "Please do not ring the telephone. I'm cut off, and if you ring, of course they will know where I am." So I hung there with the signaller until after dark. We took off our boots and slung them around our neck, took what light gear we could carry, and we made our way back in darkness, picked up the other four soldiers, and then my worry was we had to get back into our own lines, and of course they would obviously shoot at any movement from the enemy lines. So when I thought I was near enough, I called out, and one of the infantry officers, whom I'd been at the university with, called out, "Is that you, Roe?" And I said, "Yes, is that you, Cam?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "I was just going to shoot." And I said, "Well, don't." And I got the troops back in, and I suppose, well, that was the first part, but don't forget, my VC was given to me for action over 18 days. And I don't think you want to be wearied with 18 days of strenuous battle, but I must say the strain at the end of the 18 days was very severe indeed.
Because of his injuries, he was repatriated to Australia. He actually received his Victoria Cross from the Governor-General in Sydney. During the war, he had various appointments. But after the war, he joined Foreign Affairs and was High Commissioner at New Zealand and Ceylon. He was Australian Consul General in New York and had just been appointed ambassador to the Netherlands and had just taken up his post when he was offered the position of Governor of New South Wales. He was a marvellous success as Governor of New South Wales. He was there for 15 years, a man of great dignity. He really related to the people and they related to him. At the time of his death, he was the overseas vice president of the Victoria Cross and George Cross Association.
To conclude this oral history project, Sir Roden Cutler gave his views on the nature of war and remembrance on the 50th anniversary of the end of the Second World War.
The 50th anniversary of the end of the war, I think it's important. I think it's good to remember it. I think it's good to make the whole country aware of it. But I would not like it made something to look back on all the time, what we did, you know, and how we survived. I think it's important that it lives on because it's part of our national history. And I think we've got to ensure that our children, our grandchildren, and their children and grandchildren realise that it's not a commemoration of war, it's not a commemoration of glories past. It's a meeting of old friends at the present time who went through the same sort of difficulties. But it will continue, I think, as part of our national history. And that, to me, is very important indeed, because if we don't learn history and take note of it, we'll be making the same mistakes again in the future as we made in the past.
The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent, in whole or in part, the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority.